We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark, and I'm on with my co-host, Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing really well. And one day I want to see something different. Like, I don't know, I'll think about it. Because every time I listen to our past episodes, I think, I always see the same thing. I'm well. Mm-hmm. What the hell does that mean? I'm going to work on that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Today we're talking about a show that originally aired around Thanksgiving of 1990. Very exciting. And I think that this one was a mishmash. This one was and when we see it on, I watch it on YouTube. I don't know where you watch it. Mm-hmm. But this is season 3, episode 11. And I think it's a mishmash because it feels like some of these segments are so much longer than previous segments.
Oh, yeah. No, there are two segments that are total throwaways. I mean, there's really not much to them. And then there's one in the middle, and that is like the meat of this episode. And to be fair, it is parts 1 and 2. So there were like two different episodes originally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this one was odd. None of them were really connected with each other or anything. But yeah.
No, with this first one, it falls into that category of not telepathy, channeling or spirituality or being able to tap into somebody's past lives, something mm-hmm. that I know you have a real interest in. Definitely. I think most people do, but some people just have more of an interest.
Yeah, it excites my mind to think about it. But yeah, they describe this woman as being a psychic artist, and we are talking about Coral Polge.
Well, I just wanted to ask about you real quick. Yeah, this is going to be too personal.
Love it.
It's the Kim episode. So do you, very often I'll be described as somebody who is an old soul, whatever that means. I think there's different interpretations for that. You know, I'm a big fan of early like turn of the 20th century cinema. And I have a real love of between 1900 to like 1925. So is this something that people have said about you?
I have been called an old soul in my childhood, but that's also because I was born as like an 80-year-old woman. Like right now, all I want to do is like sew and watch my Law and Order and stay at home and
watch my shows,
watch my stories. And I think that's more what it's relating to. I tend to have old lady hobbies. I tend to have old lady friends. Like I am just an old lady, and I'm so happy with
that. But that's the definition of being an old soul.
Well, there you go. Then I guess I am.
you're attracted to these more than hobbies. I don't look at these things that you do as hobbies. They're really your passion. And
yeah, it's a lot.
They really kind of make you, I think, who you are. Maybe your name was Coral in the past. That would be pretty cool.
That's such a good older lady name.
But I just wanted to ask that. I was just kind of curious. But Coral was born in 1924 in London. And this takes place in March of 1990 in Clarksville, Indiana, which I did not expect.
No, because she is so British. But it's fun because at the time of her birth, according to her website, the midwife exclaimed, "This child has been here before."
Now you found that out. That was not on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Was there any indication, or is this person just kind of super sensitive, or?
I have no idea. I got no extra info on the midwife, but this is one of several people in her life who has like kind of brought her psychic powers out to the forefront. She went to a spiritualist with her mother just after World War II, and she was an artist at the time, and the spiritualist said to her, like, "You know you're a psychic artist, right?" And she's like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." But she does discover that she draws people almost as if her hand is like being guided. She draws like dead people.
Yeah, I get it. It's kind of like I think of it as channeling. And it really seems as though it's that connection that people might get into with a Ouija board.
Yeah, exactly. She'll like draw them, but at the same time, she'll tell you like a little bit about them. Like in 1984, we get to see like an interview with her and a photographer named Peter Cook. And Peter just went to go get pictures of her drawings for a magazine that he worked for. And she was like, no, let's sit here and we'll like, you know, so they like rub hands and
totally casual.
Yeah. And she starts like sketching his grandmother and she's like, oh, she used to collect her rainwater from a rose, from a rain barrel. And, you know, she's very rosy. Like, she's showing me the name Rosie. In fact, is her name Rosie? And he was like, oh, my God, because that was her last name. Her name was Minnie Rose.
Yeah, this was a very interesting thing where we see the sketch and we see the photograph of Rosie. And Rosie has these, you know, rosy cheeks. You could totally see even in the black and white photo. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I see a very strange similarity to each and every time is they always have a photograph that can be lined up perfectly with these sketches. So that's why I was wondering, do you believe, and we'll go into a little bit of the story of who she is and what she's done, but do you think she's tapping into the person and basically channeling their memory of this person? Because that, you know, they might be thinking of this photograph. So it's almost like a mimeograph, you know, and it's like transferring this thought process to her.
That is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. That is like very meta. My mind might explode just trying to comprehend
which
that.
Which is also just magic. It's amazing.
Yeah. But I when she's like in Indiana, she's at this conference and people are like paying $15 a pop. It's like a sold out crowd.
Oh, my God.
And
she's drawing.
I know. Well, she's drawing on this like transparency up on the wall and like a projector. And she's saying like, this is this young man. He doesn't know how he died, all this stuff. So I do think that she would be channeling the actual subjects of her drawing. But that's just what I thought. Now I have all this new information. I don't know what I think.
I don't know if I believe it, but I know I don't not believe it.
I know. I love it. And I think it was a fun story. I would love to be able to test it. Like, my God, that would be so cool. But we do kind of get her in another session with this awesome woman named Lorraine Ferrero. And Lorraine is like stunned that she's drawing this aunt. But to me, I mean, I didn't think this one looked that much like the aunt.
Keep trying.
And she even said like, oh, I've never met her before. But yeah, this is definitely my aunt. It's like, how do you know? But yeah, sadly, Coral Polge died in 2001. She actually has a book that is like so expensive online in like the triple digits called Living Images, The Story of a Psychic Artist.
Yeah.
And I found this really nice quote from her that said, as long as there's somebody's picture waiting to be drawn, I will continue to be used as a channel for such communication between this world and the next. This was the path mapped out for me. It is a path I tread with love and a great sense of privilege that I was chosen to do so.
It's so like selfless. It's a really sweet thing. And maybe that's an even an indication as to what kind of person she was.
Oh, I definitely think so. She was so soft and like happy. And she was just like, oh, this is great. Like, I love what I do. So, you know, anything, as always, I'm always going to be a little skeptical. But anything that brings people like love and peace and happiness cannot be bad, in my opinion.
No, I brought this story up to a friend of mine. I mentioned her to you briefly. Her name is Ivy Supersonic. I'll just leave it at that. You can Google and find out what kind of nut she is. So she's a good friend of mine, and she's started doing – she had a lot of terrible things happen in her life a few years ago, and she just started painting. And she has paintings that have physically changed in front of people, including myself. Like, you can look at the painting, and then you look at it again, and it's different.
And oh, my God.
You don't see movement. You just see – you just all of a sudden look at it, and it's all abstract. And you're all of a sudden like, well, that I don't recall at all being there. And she's shot video where in the beginning it really looks different than the end. Very strange. I have one of these paintings. I have not opened it. It's creepy to me. But I got into a conversation with her about this. And have you ever heard of a small town in New York called Lilydale?
No.
That sounds wonderful, right?
Yes.
It sounds like they have like a great cookie shop, Lilydale, or a flower shop. So Lilydale is a small community in upstate New York where it's a hamlet of, I don't know where it's a hamlet of, but it's a small town, and it is basically a commune for spiritualists and paranormal people and psychics. And it's a real amazing little tiny town. And if you ever have the opportunity to go there, it's a quaint little sweet town that you'll never find anywhere else, especially on the East Coast. So I just, it's up near like Fredonia. So it's just Lilydale, look it up. You'll find a lot of really interesting people there. And she said she knows somebody in Lilydale who, this guy who does this kind of thing, and he does it for a similar type of like price, and he really does it just for money. So I'm trying to reach out for him, out to him for you. Oh, or
thank you. I want this.
So I'm trying to figure out something, but nonetheless, there are people who do this type of thing, and I don't know if I believe them fully, but yeah. Who am I to believe or not believe? So,
well, this did kind of send me down an Etsy rabbit hole, because I was like, I want this so bad. I want to test it. If there's any truth to it, I'm sure that it's like least strong through the internet when the person's not sitting in front of you.
Right.
But I was like, I want instant gratification. So I signed on to Etsy. I've made two orders, right? I ordered one thing. It's kind of similar. It was like a past life regression experience. And I'm very excited about
it. Don't
that.
Have a tone about it. I'm not judging you. I think that what you're doing is ballsy. I think it's great that you're doing this.
It was an excited tone, I swear. And then two, this thing is very cool, where it's like a drawing of you in your past life. And it is expertly drawn. And it comes with like a little story. So if those two match up, I'm going to be like blown away. But I think it's fun and I think it's cool. And I will totally update you guys when I get those.
One thing I really want to put out there for, I'm thinking about doing this for the future of Unsolved Mystery for the people who might have an interest in doing it. I mentioned that I do read tarot cards, and
oh yeah,
based upon this author who I've become friendly with, Mitch Horowitz, I've adopted this method of three card tarot. I'm using a particular deck, which is a beautiful deck called the Hoodoo Tarot. And let me just mention who wrote this, because she sent this to me, and it was, Tiana Lee McQuillar. And she was kind enough to send me this deck, and it's really talking about you just have to look it up. It's kind of weird. There's a lot of references to the voodoo that was going on in New Orleans and in the 1800s, and a lot of really shocking imagery that is in there. It's beautiful, beautiful artwork. So
how cool.
What I would love to do is kind of like a thing where I give people kind of a reading through the internet, based, because adopting the same method that Mitch does. So I'm thinking about it, and it's one of those things that I would just love to do, and for free. You know, it's not like I'm trying to, like, you know, but to do a basic, like, it's just called a three card reading.
Love it. Me first.
Oh yeah, totally.
Okay, cool.
All right, let's move on to...
Yeah.
Sorry. See what happens with rabbit holes with me.
Yeah, we are getting ready to get depressed, so get ready. This is Johnny Lee Wilson, and got a lot of this info from Wikipedia, the National Registry of Exonerations, and you guys, I read through 71 pages of case files and court transcripts for you, so I hope that you like the research that we did, because my eyes were bleeding.
Yeah, I skimmed through it very quickly. I was like, I can't read this.
Yeah, it was a lot. So we start out that the Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter got a call from a man in prison. This is Johnny Lee Wilson, and he's like, please cover my story. I'm in prison for a crime that another man has confessed to and is in prison for, which isn't exactly true, but we'll get to it. So Robert Stack, here we go. I would like to preface this by saying this is not Mark and Kim approved. This is how the 1990s were, people. But Robert Stack refers to Johnny Lee Wilson as, quote, a mildly retarded young man. And if we say that word in telling this story, apologies. It's not our words. It is their words.
Yeah. And also we are pointing out that this is just, I don't recall in the 90s. Of course, you were barely existed. I don't recall this being a casually way to talk about somebody. Ever in my life. So, and I mean, I was born in the early 70s. So mm-hmm. we're talking like, you know, my memories are from the late 70s throughout the 80s. And I never recall there being a time where you can just call somebody, and I'll just call it the R word. Mm-hmm. It was always considered to be a negative word in my life anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And this poor kid has been just completely railroaded into a confession. If you're familiar with Making a Murderer, this guy is like Brendan Dassey all the way. But it sounded like his It sounded like his confession was audio taped.
Yeah.
So where's the audio tape? Well, it turns out from Johnny's lawsuit against the state, which he later files in 2001, the tapes that are supposed to be in the state's possessions have inexplicably disappeared. So we are definitely dealing with some interesting fancy footwork from the police.
There is a lot. I'm just going to say flat out, there's a lot of corruption here. To cover something and put it on, and to put it on him. And it just seems like there's so much work being put into this. We never get to the crux of what they're trying to cover up exactly, or who they're trying to cover up for.
Yeah. And I think it's just a matter of covering your butt. You made a decision and you were just going to stick with it wholeheartedly. But if we just want to go back to the beginning, Johnny Lee Wilson's a 20-year-old man. He lives with his mom and his grandma in Aurora, Missouri, and he has an IQ of 71, which, just for your information, I looked up Forrest Gump's IQ. Forrest Gump's IQ was 75. So he's got 4 on poor little Johnny Lee Wilson.
No, have you ever taken an IQ test?
I mean, like one on the computer. I don't know how.
No, but I mean, I think they were phased out by the time I was a kid or something. Yeah. I don't think that, at least it's not part of like the public school system.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think this was just like, oh, you go over to this class and you go over to this.
Or
class.
Maybe I'm just, you know, too low on the scale. They just didn't tell me.
It's possible. I mean, according to the classification, the current classification scale, 70 to 79 is, quote, borderline, and 69 and below is the lowest you can get. So he is pretty low on that list.
Yeah.
But according to psychologists, he had the emotional development of a fourth grader.
No, I don't. I mean, all right, he speaks on here, and I don't get this delayedness from him. I don't get this feeling. I almost feel like maybe he was just either autistic or dyslexic, maybe. You know,
it's possible. I mean, I know he's a stutterer, which I didn't notice the
first time.
The second time I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, he definitely, like, almost every single word. But it's interesting because, I mean, there are more people now with autism than there were then, because I'm sure doctors know how to diagnose it better. But apparently his, like, social interaction IQ score was somewhere around 86. His reading level was somewhere around 60. So they kind of, like, averaged it out and made it 71, like, overall scores.
Yeah. The whole thing is kind of strange. You know, I don't know why it matters that his IQ is at 71. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have morals, or he doesn't have, cognitive decision-making skills.
Well, it comes into play a lot because
I think a lot of these decisions, these poor choices that were made, were based upon purely his age, really, and his inexperience. At 16, 17 years old, I don't know how I would react if the police pulled me in.
And he's 20, to be fair,
that's true.
I mean, they say he's basically like a fourth grader. He, like, presents that way. At a fourth grader, you're not going to be like, give me my lawyer, I'm not saying anything. They had him read stuff, which he was very not proficient in reading. Like, he didn't even have a driver's license because he couldn't pass the written exam. And they had him sign and read and do all this kind of stuff. But his grandma tells us his grandma's amazing. But she says that he's a good, quiet, happy boy, and all the kids in school were mean to him. So he used to leave his bike with this woman named Mrs. Pauline Martz because the jerk kids at school used to vandalize it just to mess with him.
Things like this, we're starting to see probably he was more stressed out because of these kids just being jerks.
Probably. So he would leave it there and he'd be like, can I leave it here? And I got to say, the 90s of it all, I was surprised and happy to see how understated the reenactor played it, because the reenactor was perfect for this role, in my opinion. But he could have easily gone as like a caricature and gone over the top, and I'm glad he didn't. But this woman, Mrs. Pauline Martz, is really close friends with the grandma. They used to play cards together all the time. And she is the last surviving member of Aurora's wealthiest family. And she owned the town's largest business. I don't know what that business was.
Yeah, we never found out what the business was, right?
No. And even through researching, I didn't find out. But she has like a marvelous hat collection, jewelry. She is doing pretty well in Aurora. And like you said, she lived in like a little small house, but just because she's the wealthiest person in town doesn't necessarily mean.
But that's in a reenactment, so who knows? Like maybe it was more lavish. Maybe it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, for sure. But you know, we come to April 13th, 1986. It's 8 p.m. and Pauline Martz's house is completely engulfed in flames, and firemen find the charred body of Pauline Martz, and the official cause of death is smoke inhalation. She had been bound and gagged with rope and duct tape, and the fire was started with gasoline.
Now, I looked up as to why people will say, well, it's gasoline instead of like any other accelerant. And mm-hmm. It's not based on a chemical or anything. I mean, of course, if you smell gasoline, you're like, well, it's gasoline. But there's, from what I can tell, an investigator goes in to determine if it's arson, they're looking at burn patterns.
Yes.
And if the fire, because, you know, they kept on saying fires burn up, they never burn down. And, you know, and the, with, you know, gasoline, of course, could force the fire to go down. So, so I'm not really sure why it's gasoline instead of any other accelerant.
I mean, I hear you there. I think that gasoline is all-encompassing in this case as an accelerant, but keep in mind, it is rural Missouri in 1986.
Right, and it's easy, you know, gas is easy to get because, as I was saying, I have cans of gas in my garage right now, and yeah, I'm sure you do too, and it's just, when they pull, because later on they find a gas can, and they enter it into evidence, and I'm thinking, all right, well, probably everybody here has a gas can.
Exactly. Everything that they took from his house, I have in my house right at this moment. Right. So it's crazy. But 5 days later, the police do pick up Johnny for questioning, and they interrogate him for almost 4 hours alone. God. And he confessed. So they arrested him.
Now, you mentioned he was a minor, but he's not a minor.
Oh, you're right. He's not a minor. I don't know what I was thinking.
No, I kept thinking the same thing until you just pointed out that he was 20. For whatever reason, I kept thinking he was 17.
Yeah, he presents as younger, you know.
Yeah. It was very strange. But I do think that maybe he should have, I mean, I don't know the legality of the period of time, but if he was in this state where he's a bit delayed and everything, it's possible that he would have signed over his conservatory to maybe his grandmother. But maybe we didn't get to that point yet with him, because usually that only happens with people who are really like in bad states, like a bipolar person.
Right. And, you know, I hear what you're saying. And by all means, definitely he should have had at least his mom or his grandma there. Like, this is crazy. But they actually lured him to the police office by saying, oh, we know you lost your wallet a few days ago. We have a wallet. We want you to come take a look at it. He was like in a movie theater minding his own business. So he's like, oh, boy, like I get to get my wallet. So they take him, and he's like, anybody that comes in this room, we have to read the Miranda rights too. So we're just going to Mirandize you. So he doesn't know, am I under arrest? Am I free to leave? Like, what's going on? And then he gets there, and they're like, what did you do to that woman? And he's like, whoa, what? Like, I thought I was just supposed to get my wallet. So they just confused it enough and jumbled him enough that he wouldn't even, like, think to ask for his mom, a lawyer, anybody.
And yeah, it's such a shady situation.
Oh, it's so messed up. And on the interrogation, he's like, he keeps saying, like, I didn't do this. I didn't do this. And after 4 hours, he was like, yeah, fine. I did it. You know, and we know now you can break anybody down through enough, you know, sleep deprivation, screaming in their face. Like, you can't interrogate people for that long or you're going to get a lot of false confessions.
Yeah, if anything, I think it's been proven that interrogations like this are not reliable.
Exactly. And, you know, this was like almost 40 years ago now. So obviously stuff's changed, but a lot of pretty much the whole town thinks he's innocent. Unsolved Mysteries requested interviews with the powers that be in Missouri, and they just said, oh, Johnny's the one who did it. We got the right man for it, and we are not going to be on your show. So we get to see some pretty cool reenactments, word for word, on what actually happened based on the transcripts.
Now, we don't have the recording of the interrogation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been, quote-unquote, lost.
Right.
Unbelievable. But yeah. Wouldn't that just make it inadmissible? There's no evidence. There's no proof that it even happened.
Well, one would think they get lost between 1986 and 2001, because 2001 is when we learn that the tapes are lost. But, you know, word for word transcripts that we're seeing on Unsolved Mysteries, yeah, that happened in 1990. So maybe they had them then. I guess
maybe the transcript is proof that it existed at some point, maybe.
I guess, but it's so shady. So on the morning that all of this happened, Johnny says he spent the morning taping records with his friend.
Which I love that cute whole thing, I think.
Yeah.
If people don't know what that means, it means like a friend buys a record, like the newest Slayer album, and you bring a tape over and you just tape it.
Yeah, and he spent the whole morning doing that. He later goes and mows the neighbor's lawn, and his mom picked him up from there, drove him home, and they got home around 5, and the grandma said after that, the friend came over again to tape more records.
I started getting a little bit of a weirdness with the friend, you know. Maybe there was like something going on between these two. Was it a girl? I don't know.
No, the grandma says the neighbor boy.
Yeah.
But I hear you.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a very close friendship.
I mean, if you're spending all day, yeah. But the mom says that after the friend left, that she and Johnny put up, and I quote, 9 posters in his bedroom, which was just like a little oddly specific. But they were done with that at 7:35 p.m.
I can also mention, I looked everywhere to find out what kind of music he listened to. And I was just kind of curious, like, if they could have said, like, well, Johnny listens to metal, you know, immediately it would have been the devil, you know?
Yeah.
But I couldn't find any reference to it whatsoever.
No, me neither, but I can totally see that.
What kind of posters? Like, all of this stuff is so strange.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's strange not to find any reference of it now or relics of them. But after, like, 7:45 p.m., the mom says they left, mailed 2 letters, and went to the store, and that's when they heard sirens. So they're, like, little small-town looky-loos, and they go to see what all the excitement is about. And it's the fire at Mrs. Mertz's house. So at the fire, Johnny runs into 18-year-old Gary Wall, who is described similarly to Johnny as someone with a diminished mental capacity, although we are putting that more gently than Unsolved Mysteries did.
Yeah, they pretty much just said, they said basically what you just said, but you can watch the episode, you can hear it.
Yeah, exactly. You want to hear Robert Stack. So they were in special ed classes together, and the next morning, Gary Wall was actually questioned by police. Now, Gary tells police that Johnny told him, quote, Mrs. Martz is in there. She's tied up. You tell anybody, and I'm going to beat you up.
Now, all of a sudden, he was like the bad guy in Karate Kid, I thought. Right. He was like all of a sudden, like, when did he become the bad guy?
And it turns out that Gary Wall later said that he never even saw Johnny that night later, and that the police offered him a reward if he turned on Johnny specifically, and if he didn't, then they would put Gary in jail.
See, I wrote down, like, I'm curious if he did get a reward, and who paid him?
I don't know. I have no idea.
A lot of holes in this story. Like, or they were like, no Gary, you're not getting anything.
Right. Probably. You know what your reward is? Not going to jail. Like, it might be something like that. But Gary actually took 6 polygraphs and failed all but one, which apparently is good enough in the state of Missouri. So they take him and Johnny gets arrested.
Oh, my God.
And the police execute a search warrant for the next day. And Amazing Grandma Nellie is like, come on in, search the house. There's nothing to do here. And the police think that Johnny sexually assaulted Mrs. Martz. Now, according to the autopsy, it's inconclusive for sexual assault. But the whole time that Johnny is being interrogated by the police keep putting words in his mouth and suggesting things that match their narrative.
It's actually extremely disturbing. He's like, well, what would you use? And he names some. He's like, no, wrong guess.
Exactly. Oh, those are like the actual words that he used. What color was her nightgown? White. Are you sure it wasn't blue? Oh, yeah, it was blue. Blue-green, right? Yeah, blue-green. Like, it's like that. It's
like leading, totally leading the witness.
So obviously, too. And, you know, this gets a little rough, but according to police, this poor 79-year-old woman, before she was set ablaze... According to police, was raped anally, vaginally, and orally. And we have, you know, his words saying, oh, yeah, that's what I did. I did those things. So it's so... Ugh. If this is true, this poor woman. Either way, this poor woman.
Oh, my... I mean, there's no happy ending for this person.
No, not at all, even now. So it should be noted that apparently he had been... Johnny had been talked to from police before for exposing himself to a neighbor several times before Mrs. Martz was murdered. So the cops are thinking, oh, this guy is like a big old pervo and we're going to, you know, run into him again. He's the guy that we like for this. So, I mean, it's just all information that we got to put together. They do search his house, and in his bedroom, they find women's underwear in his bureau. And they're like, yep. This is it. So these cops with their like bare fingers are going in and grabbing all these undies out of the bureau, like shoving it into a bag. It turns out that was his mom's dresser. It was his mom's underwear.
A little bit weird, but you know.
According to the family. Yeah, a little weird. But, you know, they also find porn in his room. So because it's 80s and because it's the Missouris, they're like, ah, he's a rapist that would light an old lady on fire. Like,
don't look in my room. Not in the 80s. No.
I'm sure. I know. It's just, it's crazy. And so in the confession, Johnny also admitted that he stole some jewelry from her house and that he hid it in a barbecue pit in his backyard. Now, deputies find costume jewelry in the house, which Johnny's grandma says that she used for sewing. It's like old costume jewelry, big, fun, old lady, cheap cubic zirconia.
Yeah, it's just, it's literally the kind of thing that you would not steal. It's just.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's like you could get it at a thrift store right now for like a gallon-sized bag for $5. And that's right now. So, yeah, it's great. And it wasn't in a barbecue pit. It was in the house. So they also found and confiscated a nearly empty gas can, which they say Johnny used to start the fire. So he was charged with first-degree murder, and he was examined by Dr. Logan, William S. Logan, for the Department of Law and Psychology. And we get to talk to him on Unsolved Mysteries to see if he was fit to stand trial. And he says this is what they're looking for when they do the exam to see if someone's fit for trial.
Can I just?
Yeah, please, please.
Up to this point, it just seems as though all the evidence that points at Johnny is so light. It's garbage, right? All you really would need, all you or I would need is a halfway decent attorney. We could probably represent ourselves better and get ourselves out of this situation. It's just up to this point. It's just, I don't see them having a real case that genuinely points at him.
But keep in mind, there's stuff we don't know about always, the stuff that they keep private. I'm guessing that they told us that Johnny left his bike there to explain why his hairs, his fingerprints, whatever would be in or around her house. You know, we saw him with the gas can earlier when he was mowing the lawn and stuff like that. Like, I could see cops going, okay, yeah, we're gathering everything we can get our little hands on.
It can look shady, but I'm just saying, I don't know if it really equates to the sentence that he will eventually get.
Yeah, that's all. We get the doctor who gives him the exam to see if he's fit to stand trial. And what they're looking for during this exam is, one, does the person understand the charges against them? Two, are they able to make their own decision about whether or not to enter a plea? Three, are they able to decide if they want to testify or not? And four, are they able to help their attorney? So he says that he does not think that Johnny was competent to stand trial. So during the test, Johnny was prompted with the phrase, "I regret blank," on the writing ability test. And he wrote, I regret confessing to something I didn't do.
Which is just right away. I mean, a red flag where it's like this. All right, we have to go back to the drawing board here because clearly this is opposite of what we're talking about. He's recanting in the written word. You know,
I understand, but everybody in jail says that they didn't do it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just trying to view this from their side. I completely believe that Johnny was railroaded, that Johnny probably didn't do it. But if I'm looking at it from, like, the cop side, from the lawyer side, from anything, like, yeah, of course you're going to say you're innocent. Who in jail is going to be like, yep, I'm guilty, I did it, besides somebody who we come across later?
But at the same time, you know, the evidence that we're talking about is so shady. It's kind of, mm-hmm. I guess it's easily dismissed in my eyes. Like, that gas can, like, everybody's got a gas can. You know, everybody, you know, this person, I guess at the time, maybe we didn't know. We do have somebody who claims to have seen him. I guess I'm seeing what you're saying. I just think it's at some point explained away.
Yeah, I do too. And I definitely think that they're like, nope, we've gone this far. We are just going to put our heads down and keep going. Like, this is the guy who we are going to put it on. If right. we say maybe it's somebody else, then we're admitting that we're wrong and we are not going to do that. But he does say during his examination that police did Mirandize him. But when asked what Miranda rights are, he says, quote, it's the difference between right and wrong.
Ugh. Which is, I mean, these are just red flags again, where it's like, all right, well, either he's lying, he does know what it means, or he really just doesn't. And that kind of the fact, he kind of seems like the kind of person who wouldn't know.
Yeah, and in case you don't know, if you're from, like, a different country or something, Miranda rights are, you know, you have the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used against you, all the stuff that they say on, like, police procedurals, yeah. And it's just your rights, you know, when you get arrested. So he was examined by two psychiatrists and a psychologist, and two of the three said that he was incapable to understand the court proceeding, and the third said, no, he's fit, so I guess one out of three, again, is good enough for Missouri.
It's almost like, all right, well, let's keep sending him to doctors. Let's keep doing polygraphs until we get a positive outcome.
Until we get the answer that we want. Exactly. So they said, he told his court appointed attorneys that he was innocent, and they said, you know, there's enough evidence against you that you might get the death penalty. So he entered an Alford plea, which we've talked about before on the show, but just as a refresher, it's where you plead guilty while maintaining your innocence because you say there's enough evidence that a jury would probably convict me, but I'm still saying I didn't do it while still getting a guilty sentence. It's so silly.
It really is. And one of the things I really want to look into is if there are any really big cases that have used the Alford plea.
Yeah, I've read a couple of them just today because I really looked into this next guy who we see, D. Wampler. He's actually misspelled D. Wampler on Unsolved Mysteries. But
you know how mad you would be.
I would be so mad. You can't double check that. Oh, my God. And they pull his name up a few times. And he is like the lawyer in Missouri, from what I can tell. Like, he is a big shot. So in the court transcripts, we see that Johnny got on the stand, told the judge he didn't even know why he was pleading. He said that he didn't want to get the death penalty because he thought that the day after he went to jail, he got put to death. So this poor guy just doesn't know what's going on. But D. Wampler kind of tells us everything that's going on. He very says, like, real shortly into the plea when the judge is talking to him, he should have said, no, like, I do not accept this plea. It should have been thrown out because it's clear that Johnny didn't know what was going on. Now, for a fun fact, attorney D. Wampler's license is actually currently suspended and he's placed on probation because he misappropriated client funds, allegedly, and refused to give retainer refunds when clients cut ties with him as their lawyer. And that happened in like 2019. So he is currently has his bar card suspended.
Maybe what we need is D. Wampler.
Yeah, right. I know. Exactly.
That's kind of wild though. I mean, it's, attorneys are shady. I don't, you know, hopefully no one's offended by that, but attorneys and accountants, they both kind of shady.
And like, I have to say every side character in this story has a crazy, interesting story about them. But to get back to the trial, instead of refusing the plea and waiting for a jury trial, which is what should have happened, according to D. Wampler, the judge just kept questioning Johnny until he was satisfied with the plea. Like we said earlier, yeah. You just test him for a positive.
And he actually said that he does not understand what's going on.
Yep. But that doesn't stop him from sentencing him to life in prison.
There is so much corruption here. I mean, maybe everything just kind of lined up at the time and it looked like, well, this is a no-brainer. That's totally possible. But it's just life in prison.
Yeah.
Based upon all of, you know, all of the stuff. And it just seems really, really insane to me.
Yeah, and it's about to get even crazier, honestly. In 1988, a Kansas inmate that bondsman Warren Ormsby had bailed out in the past called Ormsby and said, "Hey, while I was in prison, I met this other guy, Chris Brownfield, and he admitted to killing Pauline Martz." So in February 11th of 1988, we're in Kansas, and we actually get to see Chris Brownfield. He actually talks to Unsolved Mysteries.
We kind of like him. I kind of liked him. I thought
a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, he had this like kind of black eye type thing going on. But
yeah,
I mean, I definitely would be afraid to hang out with the guy. But it's, yeah, you know, he seems kind of sympathetic in a way that I did not expect.
You can tell, you can't hear what the producer asked him, but you can tell that the question is basically like, why did you confess to this? And he says that he felt bad because Johnny has a diminished mental capacity, let's say, and that he also grew up with his grandma, and that's why he wanted to do it. And so I was originally thinking, are we sure Chris Brownfield is even in on this, and he's not just like copping because he feels bad for this guy? Because at the time of the broadcast, he was serving a life sentence plus 5 to 20 years for being accessory to murder. So he really doesn't have anything to lose. But it's worth noting that he was a convicted of robbing, beating, and murdering an elderly woman in her Kansas home just 16 days after Pauline Martz was killed.
Now, do you know if, is it a trend that when people commit these heinous crimes, do they go right away and commit them again?
It depends on the person, to be honest with you, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he was within the area, and this is only 2 weeks later.
And the victim was only an hour drive from Aurora. So even if you're being like transient and hitchhiking or walking there, you could easily make it there in 2 weeks.
Oh, this dude is stealing a truck. Come on.
True. But like, you know, I'm sure he probably finds a weak little old lady who lives by herself, allegedly, you know, and just goes after someone who can't defend herself. Ugh. He definitely becomes less likable. But
yeah, I mean, definitely when you put him on paper, I think if he is involved and he came forward, I'll give him credit for that. But yeah, it doesn't mean that I think that he's a good person.
Exactly. No, and I hear you. And it's a nice thing to do what he's doing, if it is the truth, or even if it's not, it's a nice thing to do to show mercy to Johnny. But according to Chris Brownfield, he and an unnamed accomplice were tipped off that Pauline Martz had a ton of money in her house because she's like the richest lady in Aurora. Right. They broke in, ransacked the house, bound and gagged Mrs. Martz. Now, Brownfield and his accomplice burned the place down because apparently they had stun gunned her, and then they lost their freaking stun gun.
Honestly, these guys are, I mean, if it was going on now, we'd be like, they're meth heads. You know, they're clearly bumbling idiots.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're like, what are we to do? I guess we're going to have to burn the place down because that stun gun has our fingerprints on it. Like, look around for a minute, you know, like, oh my God,
right, flip on a light, look around. It's but they're probably high on something. I mean, all right. It's Aurora. Maybe they PCP or something.
Yeah, exactly. And again, allegedly, but according to Brownfield, he's like, I wanted to get Pauline out of the house. I tried to race in there, but it was just too hot.
I don't know if I buy that.
No, me neither, but they fled. So some citizens in Aurora banded together and they erected a billboard that said Aurora, home of Johnny Lee Wilson, the boy in prison without a trial. And like right after it was erected, it was firebombed by somebody.
I love the word firebombed.
I know. Yeah, totally.
They had a video of it, though. So it's almost as though maybe local news came out to cover the story.
I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I'm sure this was some kind of affiliate of the whatever network Unsolved Mysteries was on at the time.
But that's a big FU to local government. That's a big FU to local police, everything. It's really, I mean, it's one of those kind of things where I'm not surprised that it was firebombed. And we know who firebombed it. You know, it was those very people that it was attacking.
Well, and this, like, completely just split the town in two. You know, some people were like, good, the guy got it. And I'm sure a lot of the people, I mean, I'm sure the detectives' families probably live there and stuff, and they're wanting to defend their reputations. But The sheriff said that he didn't believe Chris Brownfield's confession because it was part of an elaborate escape plan and discounted it, yeah. Which is crazy.
Escape plan from a life sentence. But, you know.
Yeah. By
I mean, what was he hoping to get? An extra, like, pudding cup? I mean, this guy really had no, there was no benefit, really, to telling the story.
Playing devil's advocate, could he be maybe extradited back to Missouri instead of Kansas? And during that time, he figured out a way that he could possibly escape or something?
We've seen it before, so.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, to just completely discount it because of that, like, we need to look into this more. So, D. Wampler says that Chris Brownfield did do it. He murders senior citizens, so he obviously has the same M.O. And D. Wampler was actually hired to represent Johnny to reopen the case. So Wampler says, Johnny was tricked into going down to the police station. It's what we told you before about, yeah. Like, tricking him in there with the wallet. His grandma and mom weren't even told that he was being questioned, which is probably legal, but definitely not ethical. So the interrogation started around 8:30 p.m. and it ended just after midnight. And Dr. William Logan, the psychologist who we talked to earlier, comes on to say that the interrogation was aggressive and that Johnny just didn't even know enough to ask for an attorney and end the interview.
Which I just want to, just a reminder to all of our listeners, if you're ever in a situation, you know, you just look like the guy, ask for an attorney. Just shut up. Yeah. Ask for an attorney. It's your right. It's
yeah.
Even the Canadians who listen, I think. Ask for a Mountie.
Yeah. I don't know about Canadian law.
That's my Canadian jab of the episode. I love Canada. Stop it.
So we get just a couple people telling us that at the crime scene, there was a battery-operated stun gun. And in his confession, Chris Brownfield, you know, said that he lost the stun gun and drew a picture of it. Now, this stun gun was never publicized, nothing. So that definitely leads towards thinking Brownfield did it.
I have a stun gun that I bought in a pawn shop in the 90s.
Oh, I have a couple that are shaped like rings. So when I'm out jogging, I have it on my hand. Yeah,
that's actually really cool.
Bam. Yeah. No, it's awesome. So I have two.
I have one that's like a holster. Like it's in a holster. I'll take a picture of it. And yeah. When you take it out, it almost has like a little bit of shape of a gun and a trigger.
Ooh. And if you want to share your stun guns, head on over to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast.
You know,
podcast
what a good giveaway. I am not giving away weapons.
I'm not sure how legal that is, but no.
but it would be fun, yeah.
Yeah, and in keeping with self-defense, but
actually, if we could find stun guns that are not stun guns, they're like water pistols, that'd be a lot of fun.
Like a lighter or something.
Yeah.
Too much. May of 1989, D. Wampler presents a motion that Johnny should be given a jury trial, and this motion was denied, and the judge was like, no, he knew he was competent when he pled guilty. So Brownfield refused to testify in person at the hearing, which also kind of led to him being untrustworthy as a witness.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time of the broadcast, Johnny's still serving his life sentence. He's placed in like protective custody because he couldn't protect himself in Gen Pop.
This is where I was like, the story's going to be happy. We're going to get to this happy ending immediately.
Yeah, no, but he will be eligible for parole when he is 70 years old. So September 1990, an appeal was heard in the appellate court. Bam, denied again, shut down.
And that's where I was like, my heart dropped. I was like, this is terrible. And he's just walking in. You see him walking outside the prison. He has to be kept away from the other prisoners because they're afraid that they're going to harm him. And he's just playing basketball alone.
Oh, yeah. No, this was a heart-wrenching story, honestly. But we do get an update. Governor Mel Carnahan decided that his confession was coerced and that he was pardoned in 1995 after serving 9 years.
That's a long time to be in prison.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I wouldn't want to spend 9 days in prison. But the governor actually, they said this was one of the only times that somebody was pardoned because of innocence instead of clemency. So this is like a big deal for him. And in 2003, he actually settled a federal civil rights lawsuit against Lawrence County, which is the county he was in, for $615,000.
Hopefully he got to keep some of that.
I hope so, yeah.
But, you know, I did find this one little article that came out 2 months after he was pardoned, where I'm going to assume he went on eBay or something like that, and he started bidding on a Corvette.
Oh.
I just thought it was a funny, cute little story. And all of his family and friends got really mad at him or upset. They were like, well, you don't even have a license. yeah, but he said that once it got into the bid got over $1,000, he got scared. I don't know why that's a story, but it just kind of shows he just wants to like be a normal person. Like, and he loves sports cars and he seems like just a normal kind of guy. And I believe he was 100% innocent in this particular case. The exposing himself, I don't have enough information, I believe. Most of us have exposed ourselves. I'm just kidding. And and it's just, I don't think he did this. I really don't. And his family seems nice.
His family seems super nice. But I do have a few updates. As of 2017, he is still mowing lawns in Aurora, Missouri. Grandma Nellie did die in 1996, but I'm glad that she got to at least see Johnny exonerated.
Yes.
His mom's still around, can't say anything about her. Sadly, Pauline Martz's murder has never been solved. Now, here's where we get a little crazy. In 1991, Chris Brownfield and his celly, Johnny Wiggins, were convicted of murdering 31-year-old fellow inmate Lee D. Grafton Reed. Now, on September 7th of 1988, D. Grafton Reed allegedly stole cigarettes, snacks, billfolds, and toiletry from their cell while they were working in the prison laundry. So this was a big deal. And in jail, I mean, that's all you got. And you got to protect yourself or everybody's going to walk on you. So there was supposed to be a rumble about it the next day. And on September 8th of 1988, Wiggins, who's the celly of Brownfield, takes a shank with him to go do the laundry. Sorry, I'm not laughing, but that's just, there's no justification for that. So
yes,
when he sees D. Grafton Reed approaching him, according to him, Wiggins stabbed him numerous times. Now, Wiggins stabbed him even when he was trying to run away. And we're talking in the heart, in the back, in the head, like, it was brutal. So Brownfield comes out of nowhere with a metal bar and starts bashing Grafton Reed, or D. Grafton Reed, over the head with it. The autopsy showed D. Grafton Reed had 18 stab wounds, including a fatal one to his heart, and 6 lacerations to his head from the blunt instrument.
Oh my.
So Brownfield added another 10 to 40 years to his sentence for killing him. And in 2011, he filed numerous motions complaining that he can't get parole, which is like, well, then stop killing people, you idiot.
Right, yeah, it's like, absolutely. It's like you're only there because of the things you've done.
Exactly. And I apologize for calling him an idiot because his earliest possible release date is in 2023. So my bad.
It's on April Fool's Day. So
that's true. So hopefully it's not. But, you know, in prison, I looked at his stuff. He had like 11 charges from 1996 to 2020 of like drugs and weapons and killing people and all this stuff. So hopefully he stays where he is. It seems like the right place for him.
But I am glad that Johnny got out. He got hopefully a nice settlement, and he's just living life. You know, it's he's still a relatively young man.
Yeah, yeah, he is. But sadly, somebody who is not still living life is Kenneth Inge.
Totally exhausted.
Ugh, it was so tacky. I hated that title.
Who comes up with these? I think it's that woman who calls Robert Stack Bob.
Oh my God, Keely Shaken.
You know, it would be funny. Totally exhausted.
Yeah, it's so tasteless. But we're in Edmore, North Dakota. Oh. And we are in October.
This is not a town I want to visit. No offense to our North Dakota listeners.
No, not at all. I'm sure they don't want to. Nobody lives there anymore, by the way. There was like 360 people when this story took place, and now there's like 180. So wow. People are running from Edmore. But it's October 4th, 1988. It's about 3:30, and police are investigating the death of a local auto repairman. About an hour earlier, 25-year-old Kenneth Inge's body was discovered in his garage by his uncle. Mm. And the cause of death has been ruled as carbon monoxide poisoning, and it's thought to be a suicide. Now, his uncle is Richard Nygaard, who says he wouldn't commit suicide, which, you know, a lot of family members say. But if that name sounds familiar to you, that is also the name of Chris's psychiatrist on Parks and Recreation.
I love Parks and Rec. When I saw that, it made me think, like, I haven't seen Parks and Rec in such a long time.
Oh my God. It's one of my favorite shows. It's definitely the show I've watched the most in my life. Like, I could just put that on and be happy. But
yeah, like, we have like inside jokes in my family, like fart attack and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so good. And we do notice that about 6 feet away from Ingi's body, there is a fully loaded rifle on the floor. And there's also a small pool of blood, but there's no marks on the body, no sign of a struggle. So the fuel tank in the garage is full and the ignition was turned off. So they're like, how could this guy get carbon monoxide poisoning if the car wasn't running in this sealed garage?
No, so, I was also confused here because I thought the car in the garage was a different, was the same car that he used to ram the car.
No, I did too, but it's not. It was actually a car, his friend's car that he was working on. He parked his car outside. So I thought
rammed,
that too.
He used his friend's car to ram.
No, he used his car to ram, drives home, you know, parks outside, and then sits in his friend's car.
Oh, I see.
In the garage. Okay. But we'll get there.
All right.
So we are at Kunkel's Bar in Edmore. And if there's any place in Edmore I don't want to be, it's at Kunkel's Bar at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I don't know. I heard they have a really great ladies' night special.
Oh, my God. If they called her a barmaid one more time, like they were so rude. But
well, I showed you. She's real classy, though.
I know. I showed you a picture of the bar, and it looks like a place called Kunkel's. Like, it is the worst little dive. If you look at it now, the address, like, it's just an empty lot. They just completely demolished.
Now, I've been to real dive bars. I'm sure you have, too. No, yeah. You know what? I'm not sure, Kim. You're a good girl. this is like dive bar. Like, this is the kind of place where you want to be careful if you're going to use the bathroom. Maybe use the bathroom.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe like pick up everything with your sleeve over your hand. Like it just looks gross. But it's closing time and there's only two customers. So we have Kenneth Inges, one of the customers, our guy who later turned up dead, and Curtis Heck, who is another auto repairman. So supposedly Kenneth was like, I'm going to take you home to the bartender. And the bartender's like, I'm going home with Curtis. And he's like, you're a tramp. And so Curtis is like, don't talk to my girl that way. Yeah, and so they start, like, throwing blows at each other, and Curtis, like, famously says, you know, neither one of us were Muhammad Ali. We were just wrestling. we weren't actually trying to, like, hurt each other. So he has Kenneth pinned to the ground. And keep in mind, at least in the reenactment, because we never see a picture of Kenneth, but in the reenactment, Kenneth's got 60 pounds on Curtis.
Yes.
Like, he could have easily got up. So Curtis is like, you gonna stay here when I let you up. You're just going to walk out the door. Like, don't even say nothing. Don't do anything. So he lets Kenneth up. Kenneth goes out the door. So Curtis and her are like, whoo, glad that's over. And then they hear like smash. And Kenneth's drunk ass is like in the car, slamming his car into Curtis's pickup truck. And keep in mind, they're both the auto repair guys. So Curtis said,
wait, can we also just kind of one thing that's completely glared over this entire episode is the level of drinking and driving.
Oh, I know.
It's just acceptable. 100%. It's fine. It's North Dakota.
Yeah. Oh, who are you going to run into? But seriously, no. And these people were drunk. So Curtis is like, if I'm going to have to pay for my car, you're going to have to pay for your car. So he goes with his like smashed up car and he goes over to Kenneth's house and he just starts like kicking the crap out of Kenneth's car. And the barmaid's like, get it. Curtis, get back here. And Curtis is like, hold on. And he just starts like ramming in, you know, kicking the car. And Curtis says all of a sudden he hears a groaning coming from the garage. So he goes around and he sees Engi allegedly lying in the garage. And he's like, you shouldn't have totaled my truck. And Engi's like, and he's like, sirs, you're right. Like, you should be sick because he got so wasted. And he's like, I'm just going to leave you on the floor. So, according to the police report, this is the last time that Ingi's seen alive. And we should mention that the car that he was in, you know, like we said earlier, was his car. He parked outside. His friend's car that he was working on was in the sealed garage. So, he backed into Curtis's car a couple times. So, I was thinking maybe he got carbon monoxide poisoning from his exhaust being messed up. But I think it's a moot point because I'm pretty sure they're two different cars.
See, I think, you know, with these trucks, these are disgusting trucks, right? They don't have, like, decent emission systems. So, like, nowadays, you might, you know, if you have, like, a new Toyota or something, you park it in there, you might not smell the fumes, but you'll still get carbon monoxide poisoning. These things, there's, like, no catalytic converter. It's just fumes.
Mm-hmm.
So when he walked in there, he would have been overwhelmed, probably. And this is October. At the very least, he should have left the door open. I don't know.
Yeah, but you're pissed at this guy. You're not thinking about his well-being. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like, and keep in mind, I'm going to guess that these people were well over the legal limit. Like, I think two drunk people got in a fight with each other. Yeah. And some stuff happens sometimes, you know? Like, no disrespect to Kenneth Enke. Nobody deserves to die at the age of 25 years old.
Oh, my God.
But basically, the police's theory is that Enke pulled into the garage and he is, like, waiting for Curtis because he knows he pissed off Curtis and Curtis is going to come back looking for him.
Could have dozed off, too, you know?
Right, yeah, and he's sitting there with a shotgun, and they say an hour passed, you know, from Curtis showing up at his house to Enke going home. So Enke pulled into the garage, waited for Curtis with a shotgun loaded, and he was getting sick from the carbon monoxide poisoning. You know, it's October in North Dakota. Maybe he turned it on for some heat or to listen to the radio or whatever, and he got sick from carbon. Yeah, exactly. And he got sick from carbon monoxide poisoning, so he turned off his truck, stumbled out of the truck, dropped his gun, and collapsed on the floor, which, if you ask me, is 100% plausible.
Yeah, I think so, too. Now, they did have a fight, sort of. I mean, wouldn't that have shown some level of trauma to begin with?
I mean, the police say that there was no sign of trauma in the autopsy, but there was a small pool of blood found near him. And in the reenactment, when they turn over his body, his nose is bleeding. So I can chalk that up to the fight in the bar, you know, well, if I was an investigator.
What if, like, he just is in the car, you know, he maybe dozes off for a little bit. He wakes up and he's like, I feel like crap because I'm getting carbon monoxide poisoning. He turns it off immediately, goes to get out and collapses because, you know, that's what would happen if you're getting carbon monoxide poisoning. You fall, maybe you hit your head.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, exactly. You're not, when you fall, like when you have a seizure or
and you're in a
something
truck
happens,
too, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you can fall out. But if you fall when you're medically unwell, you're not going to brace yourself with your hands. My aunt used to have seizures, and the way that they could tell was because she fell off her bike one time and her hands weren't scraped up.
Oh,
and
wow.
They were like, you know, if you're conscious, you would put your hands out naturally just to protect yourself. So if he's stumbling around from carbon monoxide poisoning, maybe he did fall and hit his head.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I mean, it's a tragic story. Nobody in their mid-20s deserves to, of course, get this. And it sounds like maybe, and we've talked about carbon monoxide poisoning, it kind of comes up relatively often on Unsolved Mysteries. Just you have to be careful. And I've said, you know, I've worked on very old cars and everything, and I'll be in there in the winter, and I'm like getting a little lightheaded. Now I'm not going to play games.
See? Look at the good that this podcast has done already.
I do want to mention, I did a quick search for real estate in Edmore, North Dakota.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I found a beautiful house, the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind headquarters.
Oh.
It is a 4-bedroom, 2-bath house at 611 Madison Street in Edmore, North Dakota. It looks original to me. Beautiful woodwork, original stained glass windows.
Oh.
Built in 1903, and it is $28,000.
Oh my God, what a steal.
It is in, it looks to me anyway, to be in really beautiful condition. I just, it's a really, really interesting type of thing. That's all.
Well, we legally have dibs, for mentioning it on this podcast. No,
you're right. We deserve the 6%.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, just to wrap it out, Richard Nygaard, the uncle, says that he thinks that Curtis, like Enke, heard Curtis kicking his truck. So Enke went out to go see Curtis. The two men had a confrontation. He fell down, was knocked unconscious, and Curtis walked away. But he realized the truck was running, so he came back in and turned it off, which is silly. But even in his version, it doesn't seem like anyone thinks that Curtis intended to kill Kenneth that night.
This is a small town death. And this is one of those things where, not to put the place down, but it's probably the most exciting and most dramatic thing to happen in a very long time.
Well, let me throw this out at you if I can't. Sorry, did I interrupt
you? No, you didn't. That was...
apparently, this is the inspiration for the first season of the TV version of Fargo.
Which is wild.
Yeah, which is so small town, it's crazy. But somebody... there's a few people online who seem to think that there is more to the story. Now, 99% of people, like myself, think that this is a family in denial and this is an accident. And it's sad, but that's what happens when you drink. Sorry. Like when you get so wasted. But there's two people online. One person on Facebook said, you know, I hope the truth comes out about this story. Like, I know the mom. I hope the truth comes out. Now, here's what happened on unsolved.com. This is from 2019. It's an anonymous comment. It could be total crap, but I'm going to read it to you. This person said, quote, I'm from this town, born and raised. It is still locally believed that Kenneth was murdered. Curtis Heck is known to be a bully and a raging alcoholic with a hair-triggered temper. He thought he was better than everyone else. He and Kenny had been at odds for a while based on mutual interest in the bartender and the fact that Kenny's repair shop was more successful than Heck's. Food for
definitely
thought.
Possible.
Just throwing it out there.
I tried to find Curtis Heck's... Not Curtis. Curtis is the one who passed away, right?
No, Kenneth no. Inge. Yeah.
So Curtis, I tried to find Curtis's current auto shop, and I could not find it.
Yeah, me neither. I think I might have found his Facebook, but I wasn't sure enough to post a link in it. He lives in, probably still lives in Edmore in this little tiny town, probably hitting up the newest dive bar. Like, he's doing his thing. I mean, he didn't legally do anything wrong. The police have said this case is closed. He died from carbon monoxide poisoning.
It's possible he lives right across the street at 613 Madison Street.
Oh, my God. Never mind. We don't want it anymore.
I'd be friends with the guy. Why not?
He seems nice enough. I mean, honestly, he presented as very honest. That doesn't mean anything, but usually, you know, sometimes you're watching it and you get the Jewel Kaler of the bunch where you're like, I don't like what this guy's selling. I didn't get that vibe from Curtis.
No, I also didn't get a vibe where he took responsibility for even really walking away from him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, true. I feel bad, but you know, that's life. That type of thing.
Yeah, that's true. And that might just be the Edmore, North Dakota way of life. I don't know.
But so, yeah, I mean, so that's it. I mean, that's where we stand. We have a lot of I think it does answer all the questions. Mm-hmm. I think one of these scenarios is a fact. And that's it. It's just small town kind of crime. I cannot believe that this is based on Fargo, the TV show. I've never seen the TV show. I've seen the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I haven't either. But I did see that was completely the inspiration for season one. So hey,
I don't know if this would make for a TV series. So that's I'm kind of curious about that. I've heard it.
No, it's so shut and dry.
Yeah, so I'm definitely going to actually look into the TV show.
Add to queue.
Add to queue. Well, Kim, thank you so much for getting together and breaking down and doing all this wild research. Unsolved.com is one of those sites that just keeps on giving, really.
Mm-hmm.
especially with its new, I mean, it's so connected to the new Netflix series.
Really yeah, the cool. comments are there. But if you want to see another cool website, still unsolved.com. That's our website. Go check it out. See episodes, all that stuff. And the aforementioned Facebook page, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast. We post all the episode resources, pictures, articles, all that kind of stuff.
I've heard nothing but good things.
Yes, exactly. I've been the one telling you them, but still, it counts.
It's an award-winning... No, it's not an award. Well, you know what? It is an award-winning show. And it's an award that I have founded. That's kind of how the Academy Awards work, right? So you kind of create the system, and then you give yourself an award. But again, Kim, thank you so much for your dedicated hard work for every episode of Unsolved Mystery. I mean, yeah, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. I almost called it something else. And as always, it's a lot of fun. And I look forward to the next.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.